So the main question that I think a lot of folks are trying to grapple with is, okay, fine, so the institutions are buying, the ETF flows are strong, February is going to be a little weaker, but at least until January, they were strong. So who's selling, right? That's the main question we're having, because I mean, there's the expectation of a lot of important news flow unlocks, right? So maybe we're going to see more banks getting into the Bitcoin space with the drop of SAB 121. There's the potential of stablecoin regulation in the US that could take the segment to new highs. So like, there's a lot to be excited about.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledit. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Most of us in the Bitcoin world are now familiar with the experience of buying Bitcoin and keeping it safe. For many of us, the act is just as simple as sending a wire or transfer of local fiat, whether that's dollars or pesos, to your exchange. And once they arrive, we can submit a buy order for the amount of Bitcoin we want. Once the order is submitted and the transaction is complete, we can then go and withdraw our Bitcoin. But now imagine that you are a large corporation looking to buy $50 million worth of Bitcoin instead of 50. Your order will move the market. And if it's not done correctly, you may end up paying a lot more than you should have for that Bitcoin. So how do large corporations transact in this industry? Mostly through prime brokerages. Prime brokerages are firms that are built to assist institutional players whenever they need to transact in the market in an efficient way. One of the top prime brokers in the space is Falcon X. And in today's episode, I have the privilege of hosting David Lawant, their head of research. David and I dove deep into the institutional Bitcoin market infrastructure, the role that prime brokerages play today, and how institutions are approaching the space. Without further ado, here is my conversation with David Lawant. David, my friend, good to see you again. How are you?
Hey, Mauricio. It's so good to see you. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
My pleasure. I've been meaning to speak with you because I think you're going to add a perspective to what we've been seeing in the markets that is going to be very unique. And I'm going to learn from it. And I think our listeners are going to learn from it. So I'm excited. The way I usually start the show is by trying to learn a little more about the person behind the professional that we all see on Twitter or read about on your research. And the way I open it is by asking you, what was it like growing up in the Lawant household? And was money or finance a big topic at the dinner table in your family?
Ooh, man, that's such a good starting question. Yeah, so I was born in Brazil. So like you, I'm originally from South America. And I had a privileged life. I'd be very fortunate in that regard in terms of financial security and all that sort of stuff. But when I was a kid, I have been through the Brazilian hyperinflation period. I was too small to remember, to be honest. But I mean, in Brazil, like if you came of age during the 80s or until the mid 90s, hyperinflation and consequences that these inflationary policies bring is kind of part and parcel with your life. So yeah, I have relatively clear memories of like, okay, there's like shortage of meat and shortage of all sorts of goods. Like this was kind of day to day in Brazil until the mid 90s. Then at that point, there were some big macroeconomic reforms that ended up stabilizing the Brazilian currency and paved the way for a lot of the development that we saw over the past few decades. But yeah, if you were born in Brazil and if you were probably low 30s or older, you probably have some memory of inflation impacting your life.
I joke with people that are now from Latin America, and I say that Latin America is like the World Cup. Every 4 years, we have a runaway government that hyperinflates away the currency and a banking system fails. And so to me, it hasn't been a surprise to see the people from our region understanding Bitcoin and having it click faster than others that haven't experienced these types of things. And my next question was going to be, which I typically ask, is do you have any experiences from growing up around broken money or broken property rights that you still carry today? And you very eloquently just explained that. A follow-on from there is, does your family follow Bitcoin? Are they Bitcoiners? Or how has that been the reaction around your broader group of friends and family?
Not at all. I'm kind of a black sheep in my family in terms of being into Bitcoin and sound money. I actually got into sound money. It's interesting because I was relatively young when these inflationary fears were very prevalent in Brazil. But I started to get interested in sound money after the global financial crisis of 2008. So I was working the investment banking industry. And then that was a big wake-up call. And I think it was a wake-up call for a lot of folks. So it's kind of interesting that for me, the wake-up call for all these monetary disarrangements we have today actually came from a U.S. event that led me to dig deeper and start to reading about Austrian economics. I like all that good stuff. And then, of course, all those memories, and you say, oh, so that was at the core of all those problems that we were having in the beginning. But it's a long journey. And then within my family, no, I mean, I'm the only Bitcoiner.
Well, that's funny. My family's all Bitcoiners. My parents and my uncles and my brothers and everybody's a Bitcoiner. My group of friends, not so much. Even though the guys I grew up with back home, they've all been ravaged by inflation. And out of 10 of us, I think the real only long-term Bitcoin holder is still me, or the people that's kind of stayed in the space and got into the industry, which is still a big shock to me that more people aren't in it, especially close to others that have been in this space and have seen it grow. But they say we get Bitcoin at the price we deserve.
It's a long and a complex journey. It's hard to overstate sometimes how hard it can be, right? You have to overcome so many of your prevalent beliefs. So yeah, it's a journey. Everybody, I think, will eventually go through it.
So let's keep on your journey. You grew up in Brazil. You went to your undergrad degree in Brazil, which interestingly, you did your undergrad on electrical and electronic engineering. And then you went straight into banking and worked in the banking sector in Brazil. There's a point in there where you went and got your MBA at Stanford. And I believe from what I saw on your career trajectory, that seems to have been the platform through which you pivoted between finance to digital assets.
Oh, yeah.
At what point in this journey does Bitcoin come into your life? And what made you make the decision to basically do your MBA and move into this industry?
So I'm an engineer by training. I actually worked as a software developer for a couple of years during those 30-hour week internship during college. But then after I graduated, as you said, I moved to finance. That was a very typical path in Brazil at the time. It probably still is. A lot of engineering graduates end up going to investment and finance type of professions. And I did that for 11 years and was happy, was working very hard, but there was a lot going on. And then it comes to the point I mentioned, like the 2008 global financial crisis. I started to read some folks that had kind of an alternative take on what were the problems that led to that crisis. So I started to read folks like, and a lot of them are gold bugs. So folks like Peter Schiff and Jim Grant, of whom I'm still a big fan, Peter Schiff a little less so. I started to see that those guys had a different framework to understand, not even the crisis, but economics in more general. That kind of led me to Austrian economics. That was, of course, a multi-year journey because it was not my full-time job. It's just a thing that I will do whenever I got interested. And then by 2015, maybe 2016, I was already deep in Austrian economics and sound money and gold circles. It's not something that you would have in, let's say, polite conversations in finance circles. It's mostly, at least at the time for me, for the environment I was in, was just something that you would do kind of on your own. And that had a few guys here or there who were also interested in the same thing. And then I learned about Bitcoin probably at around that time. But I had the gold bug view. I was like, hey, there's no way this thing will replace gold. So for actually 2 years, I was just aware of Bitcoin. I was aware of the sound money kind of thesis, but I just couldn't accept Bitcoin as that solution. So like a year or two later, that's when Bitcoin really grew on me. And that's why I actually moved to the US. So I went to business school exactly with the intention of trying to understand whether someone can develop an institutional investor career in the Bitcoin space. at the time, of course, was basically only Bitcoin. That's basically why I came. Then I ended up staying. I live in California. California has its issues, but it has some great things like the weather and a lot of great things to do. So I ended up staying in California, and that was my shift indeed from traditional finance to work in the Bitcoin and crypto industry. And then after that, I started to work on funds. And now I work for FalconX, which is a crypto prime broker, a company that serves institutions. So yeah, I mean, interesting that you spotted that. This was very much the turning point.
When I'm preparing for this, I always try to dig a little deeper and try to make questions that are going to draw hopefully some interesting insights from you. But another thing I noticed is that your career in digital assets has also been with a large focus around the research component. And you've worked with some of the top firms in the space, both from what I see always on the research side. I wanted to ask you, what drives your love for research? You're currently the head of research at FalconX, which we are going to get into in a second. But what is it that drives your love for research?
So perhaps to put into context, during these kind of 10, 11 years that I was working TradFi, I was a research analyst. So that's basically what I did for the pretty much entirety of this period. I worked a little bit on investment banking on the deal side here and there. But like for most of the time, I was a research analyst. And I think I just like research. I always think about what are the things that you like that everybody finds boring. And that's kind of it for me. I like digging into the documents and getting the data, trying to figure out if the data is right, and perhaps that's where you can find an interesting insight. The other thing I like about research is that there's not only this analytical work, but there's also the interaction with other very smart folks, like talking to you and so many interesting people in the space, and also get to write. So I think it's an interesting combination of more analytical work and also content production and talking to people that I think it's really hard to find. So yeah, I'm a lowercase researcher, I would say. I'm not like doing protocol type of stuff. It's more like markets, but I'm just passionate about understanding markets, talking to smart people, just something I like to do. And I was pretty fortunate to figure that out relatively early in my career.
That's awesome. And you know, you're really good at it and you love what you do. I think it comes across. Now let's get into a little bit of markets and more about your work today. So you, as mentioned, are at FalconX, which is one of the top firms in the space. I'm going to ask you, can you explain to us what it is that you do for those that may be unfamiliar? But as a big player in the institutional market, you get a view of the market structure at an institutional level that few people get. Could you walk us through some of the critical parts of this infrastructure and the role that firms like FalconX play in this ecosystem?
Yeah, for sure. That's a great question and a topic I love to talk about. I've been at FalconX for about 2 years now. And one of the pleasures of joining a brokerage firm like FalconX is that you get to go deep into the bare bones of how the market actually works. So perhaps I can start with what FalconX does. And FalconX is a crypto prime broker. Prime brokerage is a concept that is very established in traditional finance, and it has been ported to crypto over the years as the market structure of crypto has matured. So FalconX started actually in 2018 as an OTC desk, and then it started to offer more and more services. And today we have this prime brokerage concept. The actual concept of prime brokerage is slightly different from TradFi, but I think the important point is that there are a number of reasons for why many institutions, they would rather interact with a prime broker instead of, for example, going directly to an exchange. And I can give you perhaps an example of how a retail workflow would look like and how the institutional flow would like. And maybe that will highlight some of the differences and why firms like us exist. So let's say if you're a retail person and let's say you want to buy some Bitcoin. So there's different ways to do it, of course. But the most common way probably for people to do this would be to wire fiat to an exchange or either fiat or stable coins to an exchange. Now you're going to wait for that wire to hit, and that might take, let's say, a few hours or a day, depending on the company you're interacting with, depending on the fiat rails you're using. And then you're going to just put an order in the order book of that exchange. You're going to get your Bitcoin, and then you're going to do something with it, right? Maybe you're going to take it self-custody, maybe you're going to use it on Ledger, whatever it is. The institutional process is significantly different. Why? Because imagine that instead of just being, let's say, me or you buying like a fraction of Bitcoin, what if you're one of these large ETF issuers and you actually need to buy tens of millions, hundreds of millions, sometimes $1 billion in Bitcoin, and then you need to do that in an effective way? What if you are, let's say, Michael Saylor or one of these large corporations that need to also buy a massive amount of Bitcoin at once? These orders, they're way more complex, and they are not just orders that you can just put on an exchange order book, because that would provide really bad execution for you. So that's one of the things that we do. Like, a lot of these firms come to firms like FalconX because we are connected to this very broad liquidity ecosystem in Bitcoin and crypto more generally. So we're connected to OTC desks, market makers, miners, other funds, and the exchanges themselves. But whenever a client comes to us and they can come with some pretty sizable orders, we can give them a very good price that will allow them to do this with some pretty good execution. And then sometimes this price difference might not look very big, but when you're talking about these large volumes, they can actually make a big difference in your P&L. The other component is the credit component. So like, imagine if a fund wants to trade on an exchange, but they don't have the funds there. So they're not going to wait for a day or hours for a wire to hit the exchange. They can, for example, use our balance sheet. And this is one of the things that we do. So we provide a pretty broad range of services, whether that's liquidity provisioning, whether that's spot or derivatives. We have Bravo, which is a full subsidiary of FalconX that has a CFTC swap dealer license. What that means is that we can do some very regulated type of derivatives instruments that are very familiar for banks and asset managers that are in the space and want to look for a familiar and regulated way to have access to this asset class. So there's this whole liquidity provisioning process. There's also the credit side of things. There is also custody. And then a bunch of auxiliary services like market making, research, which is what I do. So what we try to do is to be a one-stop shop for institutions that have this somewhat different type of requirements when they want to access the Bitcoin market or the crypto market compared to a traditional retail person.
The demands and needs of a person trading $100 million are very different than those of a person buying $100. And it'll have dramatically different impact on the market. If you just go and dump a market buy order for $100 million, you're just not going to get the best price. So there is this idea of efficiency and scale, and you guys are basically optimized for these types of large transactions in a way that retail exchanges are not. And I think it makes a lot of sense because you will be effectively the equivalent of an exchange to a general person. Like, you would argue that a person could get a lot of the services, maybe not credit and others. So that's a really good point. You guys go above and beyond what an exchange offers, and you offer interconnectivity to effectively all exchanges instead of just one exchange, or a great number of them instead of just one.
I think that's a good way to put it. And the other interesting thing is that we think about this institutional crypto market as this monolithic block, but actually institutional investors can be very different among themselves. Thinking about the different personas we cover, there's venture capital funds, there's hedge funds, there's prop desks, there's banks, asset managers, Bitcoin miners. There's what we call the retail aggregators. These are like institutions that aggregate retail flow, and then they need a liquidity provider to help them with market access. Actually, it's a very heterogeneous group of clients that might have even different needs among themselves.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, Ledin is a great example of what a retail aggregator would be. And we've known you guys and worked with you guys for many years. So that's a great example. The question I have, because you're spending so much time talking to these institutions that are so different and have so many differences than a normal market participant would, do you notice any difference between how these institutions are approaching Bitcoin versus how they're approaching stablecoins versus how they're approaching every other asset? What is your view, and do you agree with that type of segmentation?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Especially over the past year or so, I feel like Bitcoin has been decoupling from the rest of crypto, which I personally think it makes sense. I think Bitcoin is categorically different from the rest of crypto just because of its intrinsic properties as I'm sure many folks have come to the podcast to talk about that and how just like gold is different than other commodities because it's a monetary asset. I think Bitcoin is different from crypto because it has these limited supply, like auditability, immutability. It has these properties at a level that I don't think any other blockchain has. So Bitcoin's definitely different. And then stablecoins also clearly emerged as a very interesting use case for, let's say, blockchains over the past years, right? So it's a very efficient way to transact in dollars. It can be a very efficient way to access dollars depending where you are. So yeah, I think it's very fair to say that Bitcoin is kind of in its own category. Probably since the launch of the ETF, I think this has been becoming clearer and clearer, even among a mainstream investor audience. I think stablecoins is a major area and it's probably still early days. I mean, there's a lot going on in the stablecoin space, a lot of investments, a lot of new things still being created there. And then the rest of crypto, there's interesting stuff and I don't want to minimize that. I think that there are certain ecosystems that have been actually drawing a fair amount of institutional interest. So there's things like Hyperliquid, Solana, perhaps at least until recently. There's a lot going on in some of these ecosystems, but they feel a lot more like a venture capital type of bet. It's more like a new kind of technological platform, while Bitcoin is probably more like a macro asset. So I think it makes sense to think of Bitcoin as separate from the rest of crypto.
And are you seeing among your client base, are there any differences to, for example, what an institution of a large size uses a stablecoin for and how are they approaching Bitcoin and versus how they're approaching everything else? I guess what I'm trying to understand is I have this idea in my mind that there is a cohort of big companies now and firms that are buying Bitcoin to hold it on their balance sheets, potentially to do other things like selling covered calls on them or trying to get yield on them or use them for liquidity with something like Ledin. We've done deals for publicly traded companies and a bunch of companies that have Bitcoin under treasury. Is this becoming more and more common for us? On stablecoins, I see them a lot as a settlement layer, even for settling things between clients of Falcon, like firms like Ledin. I can use stablecoins to settle over a weekend where banks aren't on. And I know that this is happening with other parts of the space, just for the people I speak with. On the third one, I think on your side of the house, there are fraud desks and funds out there that are in the business of speculating on these faster moving, riskier assets. So I guess what I'm trying to determine is whether my characterization is accurate or whether if I'm missing something and, you know, Mao, no, they're using Bitcoins to settle and things like that. So I would love to get your take on how they use these instruments and if they do it differently.
Awesome. This is a great question. So let's break it down. I definitely think that stablecoins is something that is very well established in this industry. Of course, trading desks like ours operate 24/7. We're not restricted to only New York Stock Exchange market hours, so we trade 24/7. Stablecoins are a very big settlement instrument. Perhaps the only thing I would add here, and honestly, I think it's a use case of stablecoins that sometimes is not as well advertised or not well known, is the usage also of stablecoins as derivatives collateral. Because when you want to trade derivatives, you need to post some sort of collateral. And this is true in crypto, this is true in traditional finance as well. So if you want to go to the CME and you want to open a derivatives position, a futures contract, let's say, the CME will ask you to post some collateral. And that's how they do all their risk management. That's part of why they're such a great platform. The same happens on the crypto side. And today, I think stablecoins is basically the main means to provide collateral to derivatives contracts. This is an area that might change in the future as well. So crypto is very efficient. The crypto market structure has been maturing in an insanely interesting way. But one of the things that we're a little bit behind is that when you're posting collateral for like a derivatives operation, you're still using stablecoins, which don't give you any yield. So the carry is kind of relatively unfavorable for whoever is opening that derivatives position. So that's why things like tokenized money market funds could become interesting as well in the future, at least from this kind of collateral posting side of things. But Yields aside, yield-bearing instruments aside, stablecoins are great also for collateral management, because when you are lending or borrowing, you need to be able to move your collateral very quickly sometimes. And whether that's derivatives or credit, stablecoins kind of provide them. So that's one thing I would say. The second thing is that folks starting to use Bitcoin, I'm calling this kind of the expansion of different use cases of the Bitcoin blockchain, perhaps, right? So like trying to extract some sort of yield on a Bitcoin position. I think this is a trend, and I actually think this trend is going to grow from here, right? We're seeing all these platforms that are trying to do this in a more decentralized way. But I can tell you that it also happens in like centralized venues and centralized platforms like us. And we see folks doing that all the time. You can do it through options. You can do it through more like credit instruments, but it's definitely a big trend.
I can echo that because the letter we offer growth accounts for people to earn interest under Bitcoin in select markets. It's a very popular product. People that have enough Bitcoin and want to make extra income off it find that as a great avenue to generate that income. And we also have DCNs, which is basically dual cryptocurrency notes, which are contracts that in some ways offer similar structure than a covered call would or a covered put would. So 100%, it's growing. As people understand them more, I think there's a lack of awareness, as there was, I think, for Bitcoin-backed loans. The awareness is kind of grows as the product proves itself. That it's going to be probably one of the next cats to come out of the bag. I think Michael Saylor did that for Bitcoin-backed loans and others. And I think someone else is going to end up doing this. Now you're seeing a lot of these miners talk about using some of the balance sheet to go get yield. And we're starting to see that. I think that's going to be one of the things that we're going to see. The market's going to get flooded with some of these big Bitcoin balance sheets that are even taking slight portions to go earn yield, but the slight portions of a very massive pie are going to make a huge pie. And so that's a market that I'm keeping my eye on to see how it evolves. Another thing I've been dying to ask you about. More recently, our industry has, in my very personal opinion, been dealt several black eyes with some high-profile meme coin pump and dumps that have caused a lot of pain and public outrage. However, they've also caused some great opportunities for those who are close to the market and in some ways willing to participate in these types of events. I don't, and Ledin does not, and nor do we have any plans to do so. But I'm very curious to hear what feedback you've had or seen from institutions around these recent phenomenons.
That is a great question. And I think it speaks a little bit to this differentiation between Bitcoin and these other asset classes. Meme coins are actually a very interesting phenomenon. I don't dislike them, but I'm not a huge fan as well, personally. You actually wrote a piece about this over a year ago, and we were looking at liquidity trends, and that's when you had only the quote-unquote OG meme coins. So it was like more Dogecoin and Shiba and maybe like Bonk, and some of these were starting to come off. But you could already see in terms of the liquidity trends and how much volume some of these assets were pulling on centralized exchanges, you could already see that they could stay for a while. And I mean, to this day, Doge is a relatively liquid asset in centralized exchanges. And then, of course, you had the development of some of these, I want to call them meme token launchpad, like pump.fun type projects that allowed us to produce these meme coins, as you well said before we started our conversation here, on an industrial scale. So that's when you had this proliferation of meme coins that has been really a sight to behold. And that honestly drives a lot of the activity on the Solana network and on the Solana blockchain. I think there's some of it that happens on Base, which is an Ethereum layer 2, but also a lot of that happens on Solana. Of course, the Trump meme coin, perhaps that kind of marked to the top, was like a very unexpected event. I think for many hours, many folks were trying to figure out whether that was real or not. We saw some institutional demand to the point that we started to support Trump over the weekend. So like many folks at FalconX had committee meetings in like the very late hours of the night on that Friday before Trump took office that the meme coin launched. And then we had some like less pleasant experiences, right? So I feel like the Melania token was a lot less well accepted. And then, of course, we had this Malay token that honestly just seems like a little bit of a misstep. And there's a lot of things to discuss here. What I want to say about meme coins is that I don't want to fully rule them out, because I think there's something about using this speculative component as an initial go-to market strategy for something. This can be interesting. But I don't think this can be the whole thing. So like maybe that's the issue with meme coins. Maybe like they're a V1 of something that's going to be a lot more awesome in the future. But I do want to say that right now there is kind of an environment of exhaustion a little bit. I feel like we had perhaps too many projects, too many of these tokens. I think they failed. There are conversations about some of the market participants or folks who are handling some of these markets not being totally correct. Yeah, I think we're now going definitely through a hangover phase for meme coins. This kind of reflects a little bit on the Solana price. If you see like over the past couple of weeks, Solana is down probably something like 20%, while Bitcoin and ETH are kind of flat. So I think it reflects a little bit the exhaustion that we had with this space. The cycles are getting much shorter. There's been a lot going on, and I feel like the market is a little tired.
I would echo what you said. I think one of the things I appreciate about meme coins is at least their honesty. Their honesty in what they're not pretending to be. One of the things that have bothered me around the previous iterations of these speculative tokens, which in my view, outside of stables, most of them have been, if not all. And in the past, you used to have this veneer of a white paper and a project and some tokenomics, and they try to make you believe that the token was going to accrue value in some way. That became less and less over time. Then it deranged into things like NFTs. You didn't have to read through them as much. It's a pretty picture and you like it. And now it's just completely gone to, you don't need a white paper, you don't need a business. You're just a logo and a meme and something funny. And then just go to try to pump this thing. So at least they're being honest about what they're trying to do, or more so than the previous iterations of them. But yes, we were chatting earlier about some of the market color that you've been seeing and some of the stats and data that you thought was interesting. Can you share and some color around some of the price action? We were just touched on Solana and, you know, some of the major ones, but I'm really interested in what your views are for Bitcoin and what you're seeing in the market, if there's anything you could share.
We're in a very interesting market environment for Bitcoin, because I think we're on the verge. We're actually already seeing probably the most significant regulatory unlock that Bitcoin has ever had. I think there's definitely like a lot of expectations and some measures that have already been taken, and we can talk about those a little more. But price has been flat for like a couple of months, probably, right? So the price of Bitcoin is probably ranging in the 100K, maybe 95 to 100K range for quite a while. I mean, we had some intraday volatility, but overall prices haven't deviated too much from this range. And one interesting thing I believe we're seeing is that there seems to be institutional excitement around Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin has a very compelling investment case. I think Bitcoin is understood as this macro asset, gold-like type instrument, like just it's newer, it's less developed, it's less recognized by the market. So it will have its idiosyncrasies. But I think that the Bitcoin investment case is fairly well understood by like many institutional investors, and not only Bitcoin specific, right? You can talk to a lot of these very smart macro folks. I think a lot of them understand what is the role that Bitcoin can play in a diversified macro portfolio. I think a lot of these folks and a lot of the institutional folks more broadly, they remain positive. To give you one data set, I can give you like some high-level information from our desk. Since January 20th, about 60% of the volume that we had coming from clients were to buy Bitcoin, and only 40% was to sell Bitcoin. So what I'm trying to say is that 60% was buy, 40% was sell. This is a very common ratio that folks in trading desks call, which is the buy-sell ratio, right? So our buy-sell ratio is 60 over 40, which is 1.5. This is actually relatively high. I mean, for large institutional desks that have two-way flows, 1.5 is not a small number. If you take probably Ethereum, Solana, this number is a lot closer to 0.9 to 1 point something. While for Bitcoin, these flows have been really strong. And this is basically spread across pretty much all the investors persona. So like hedge funds, you can think about retail aggregators like you folks. So very interesting to see that from the institutional side, we still see pretty strong appetite. If you combine that with the fact that ETF flows in January were actually very strong, it was like a little over $5 billion, which is more than what we saw in December. And I think most of that ETF flow is actually real money. I'm not sure if we'd call it institutional, but at least mainstream finance type of flow. So the main question that I think a lot of folks are trying to grapple with is, okay, fine. So the institutions are buying, the ETF flows are strong. February is going to be a little weaker, but at least until January, they were strong. So who's selling, right? That's the main question we're having, because I mean, there's the expectation of a lot of important news flow locks, right? So maybe we're going to see more banks getting into the Bitcoin space with the drop of SAB 1-to-1. There's the potential of stablecoin regulation in the US that could take the segment to new highs. So like, there's a lot to be excited about. But one thing that folks at TradingDesk and I spend a lot of time on is analyzing the Bitcoin order book. And one thing that you can see is that whenever Bitcoin crosses the 100K level, the order book gets very tilted towards the sell side. So I think this is mostly coming from like general retail, honestly. But I feel like whenever we cross this barrier of 100K, I think you're still having these waves of more like general retail coming to sell. And that has been interesting to see. Overall, though, to most folks we talk to, they're obviously very excited about Bitcoin. I think it's very rare to find an institutional investor, at least the folks we talk to on a more regular basis, who is not yet optimistic about Bitcoin. You can look into other signals as well. I don't want to drill too deep, but if you look at like the options market, we're also seeing some interesting signs there. So like, if you look into these more institutional, or perhaps let's call smart money and quote unquote smart money market, I think there's reason to be excited.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, and I have the same question. Who is selling? Some circles suggest that it's some of the larger Bitcoin holders that have had positions for a really long time. These are guys that were in mining since 2012, 2013, 2014. And also given where they are right now in their point of life, if you think about it, you got into Bitcoin in your mid to late 20s, and now you're in your mid 40s, and you're probably looking for a bigger house, you got a bigger family. And so I think this all kind of maps to earlier Bitcoiners with sizable positions coming in. And even though from a relative basis for them, it might not be big because they might have thousands of coins. They might be coming out to the market with 100 or 200 coins, but they're coming out in size at times. The aggregate of their small relative share becomes a somewhat material nominal portion of the order book. I think there's some data that supports that. But that's fascinating. And it is really interesting because your flow in many ways combines that of OTCs. And I guess the only ones that it wouldn't combine would be some of the larger exchanges that wouldn't be these retail aggregators. So I think that the delta that we're not seeing is coming from, to your point, these bigger exchanges and these order books getting tilted on the broader markets.
Yeah, so many cogs. That's interesting. The final thing I'll point out, I think, is that also the other thing we need to keep in mind a little bit is that the Bitcoin market is now operating at a very different scale than it used to operate in the past. So perhaps to give you a sense on like kind of numbers, if you look at Bitcoin in the spot market, it used to trade, let's say in 2024, when we were kind of ranging in that 60K, 60 something K range, like all the way until the election, Bitcoin was trading like $10 to $20 billion a day, which is a fair amount, is a big number, but that's where we were until things started to take off around the election. After the election, Bitcoin was trading like $35, sometimes $50 billion a day. I mean, the type of flow that you need coming in to move an asset that can trade $50 billion in a day is also different, right? So like what I'm trying to say is, to put that a little bit into context, is that $5 billion of ETF flows is awesome, but when Bitcoin trades $10 billion in a day, perhaps that's enough to move the price. And these are monthly ETF flows, right? $5 billion in a month versus $10 billion traded in a day. But now we're trading a lot more. So like, it's not the case right now because the market now is a little bit more in apathy mode. But at least until like the end of January, the market was exceptionally liquid. I mean, some of Bitcoin's highest trading days were happening in the beginning of 2025. So it also might require more capital than we are used to seeing in order for us to break from these kind of key price levels, right? So let's see how things will play out for here.
That's a really interesting insight, David. And that maps out for us as well, because January was our biggest volume month in the history of our business. And it was multiples and multiples of what it was pre-election. So basically what you're seeing in the broader markets, even on an aggregate basis, maps to us that would be part of all those aggregates. Now, I want to ask you a question about your most recent research piece, which was great. I found myself nodding a lot when I was reading it, but I want you to elaborate, if possible, on your view, which was that you foresee the rest of the year being a gradual ascent for Bitcoin post-elections. And please keep me honest if I'm interpreting that right. And you mentioned a really good point around how investors were positioned leading up to the election. And I think that the case you were making, which I agree with, is that the positioning was already done before the election. And we had a post-election bump, which carried us from the 70s to the 100s, which is where we're trading now. So I think that what you were trying to say is that people were already expecting this outcome. The outcome happened. It got validated. But from here on out, we're going to need new things and new money to take us to those levels. And that's not going to be a step function like we saw in the election. So is that right? Can you elaborate on that a little bit and how you reached that conclusion?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. Of course, there's always one or other news flow item that can completely change things. And some of these are kind of relatively unpredictable. Perhaps the one that is on the table right now is the strategic Bitcoin reserve. Like, there's some things that can make a binary change in the market. But just putting those aside, I think you put it well, Mauricio. I think what took us from, let's say, the 60, 70K to 100K range is, okay, this new administration is good for Bitcoin. And that was like this general perception. And we didn't need many actions, many actual regulations in place or many regulation unlocks in place or things like that. It was just the impression that this new administration would be good for Bitcoin. And that's what took us to 100K. But what's going to take us above 100K? Now we are beyond the perception camp. I think now we need to start seeing some of these things actually coming to the market. And a lot of them will actually take a while to materialize. Like, we had an amazing news for the Bitcoin market that a lot of folks are not paying enough attention to, which is the removal of SAB 121. So, I mean, you can have a potential block of banks starting to get involved with Bitcoin a lot more directly than they have been in the past. This should be a major reason for excitement in the industry. But I think we're now at the phase when just telling me this is not enough. I actually want to start to see big bank A or big bank B actually starting to build that operation and those flows coming. So I think that's basically where we are. I think we need to start to actually see some of these things taking shape. We're going to see a bunch of market structure improvements. Perhaps ETFs will now be allowed to do in-kind creations and redemptions. I don't want to bother you with the details, but that can lead to more efficient markets. But I think that a lot of these things, first, they take time, right? Of course, we have an administration that is willing to make things happen, but there is a legislative process. After you approve new legislation, there's a rulemaking and kind of implementation process that things need to go through. And I think we're going through that. So that's why I think perhaps 2025 is going to look more like a gradual rally than we have in the past. But to be honest, we never know, man. One thing I've learned about this market is that it's always an expert in proving us wrong. And as I mentioned, there are these binary events like the strategic Bitcoin reserve that could shift the mood pretty quickly. So I wouldn't be surprised if the kind of depiction I'm making is not right. But the thing that I'm pretty confident about is that everything we're talking about are positive, useful items. It's very hard to see something endogenous from the industry that is looking that would hurt price significantly. Of course, these things can always come. And I think the main risk that people are paying attention to right now is macro. So like on the macro side, there is uncertainty around trade policy, fiscal policy, central bank independence, inflation. Like, the macro scenario is a little bit murkier than it was probably 6 or 7 months ago. And crypto can get dragged down and Bitcoin can be dragged down just from the correlation angle. But as long as on what depends on the industry itself, I think we're on a pretty good shape.
That's great. I think just by looking at what the shiny yellow rock is doing, we probably are out to a good next few months or years in the Bitcoin space. I think, strangely, in this potential part of the microcycle, gold could be acting as a red herring for future Bitcoin price action, which it sounds a little bit crazy to say, but more people know to run for gold when things are uncertain, and then they do to run for Bitcoin. But eventually, Bitcoiners catch up to the goal. And just imagine the size of the relative flows that must have been going into gold recently to move a $20 trillion asset 50% higher over the course of God knows what, 12 months or something. It's been this rally. It's been up 50%. And it's a massive, massive asset. And year to date, gold is up by almost the entire market cap of Bitcoin. Just year to date. What insane, for most people listening, go look at the chart and go look at the difference, the size of these markets. So the point David was making earlier, it takes a mountain to move the price of gold. And it's been moving a lot. So that's fascinating. Before I let you go, do you have a view that you can share on where we end up the year in Bitcoin price-wise?
I think in terms of price, I can give you honestly, I think it would be just a random guess. Most folks I talk to, I don't think they would be surprised to see the Bitcoin price at something around 150, 160K at some point over the next 12 to 18 months. You can see some of these things, even in the options markets. You can look at Bitcoin options open interest by Strike, right? So you can look into the options market just to try to see where folks are placing their bets. So right now, the most liquid options contract is the one that expires at the end of the quarter, so at the end of March. And here, most of the open interest is in calls, which means these are expressions of a positive expression on the Bitcoin price. And a lot of the strike is in the 120, 110, and 150K price level. So you can see that the options market is still pretty tilted and positioned for topside structures. I don't think a 150, 160K price would scare anybody or feel very weird compared to most of the investors and folks that I talk to. So yeah, that's the way I try to think about it. I mean, coming up with the price is hard, but I just try to see what are the folks' comfort levels. And that seems to be a pretty common one. The other thing I want to highlight is that this 150, 160K will be an interesting milestone as well, because that would be about 15 to 16% of the gold market cap. As an Austrian economist, a lot of folks who study this market and economic history know that silver has been about 1/6 of gold's market cap for a very long time. And this was a pretty constant ratio until we started to mess with the monetary system 150 years ago. It will be interesting to see Bitcoin get to that level, right? So I think that's a cool milestone that I'm looking forward to.
That should put us around 3 trillion. I think it's 60 something with 1 trillion. We're 100 now. We're about 2 trillion. 150 would put it around 3 trillion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, roughly 16% of gold's market cap. I'm looking forward to that when it happens.
Well, that was great. David, I wish we had another hour, but we're coming up at the top of the show now. Where can our listeners learn more about your work and about FalconX?
Yeah, so you can look for FalconX. We're on Twitter. You can look at falconx.io. We have an insights page where some of our research is shared. I'm also on Twitter, dlawant, D-L-A-W-A-N-T, my last name. So I post some charts or some tidbit analysis here or there. And I'm always happy to talk about Bitcoin. So if you want to reach out, my DMs are open. Just ping me there.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for making the time to come by. I know you've got a very busy schedule and no shortage of things to write about to your institutional clients. So thank you for making the time, and I will bring you back within some time so you can give us more updates on what the institutions are up to.
Sounds good, man. Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
Likewise. See you soon. I've always been very interested in how life experiences shape who we end up becoming. In David's case, he experienced hyperinflation at a young age growing up in Brazil, but it wasn't until he was living in the US and experienced the 2007 financial crisis in the flesh that he started asking questions about money. Then he took an interest on gold and later found Bitcoin. He was able to connect the dots between what he experienced in Brazil and later in the US. David did a great job breaking down how institutions participate in the Bitcoin space and how their needs are different from those of retail investors or individuals. Prime brokerages play an integral role in the Bitcoin market infrastructure, and we will continue to see them grow and flourish as more institutions come into the space. Make sure to check out David and FalconX, as they always put out some great research content. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.